This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. Just ahead, the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina is expanding a federal supplemental food program to reach seniors in Onslow County. And craft distillers are hoping a bill that's cleared the state Senate could give them a push to parity with local brewpubs and wineries. As the summer travel season starts to pick up, tourists exploring the Outer Banks usually plan a day trip to the charming community of Ocracoke. The island is only accessible by boat, and that's part of the appeal. But getting there has become somewhat of a challenge due to routes that are safer but take longer. Wait times during peak season have increased to nearly 2 hours. Now, the North Carolina Department of Transportation's Ferry Division is one step closer to easing summer congestion. They announced last week a $4.2 million contract was awarded to Armstrong Marine Incorporated of Port Angeles, Washington, for the construction of a 98-passenger catamaran-style ferry to be built in the company's Eastern Shipyard in Swansboro. This week, I spoke with communications officer with the Ferry Division, Tim Haas, about the passenger-only ferry service that will run 4 round trips per day to one of the most popular spots on Ocracoke Island.
All of our current ferries, of course, are car ferries. You drive on them and you drive off of them. And you can also ride as a passenger, but most people use them as car ferries. This 98-person ferry, this is a passenger-only ferry. There will be an indoor seating area, an outdoor seating area. There will be bike racks, so if you plan to bicycle around Ocracoke, you'll be able to do that. But it's a faster ferry. Our car ferries run at an average of about 10 knots. These can get up to 25, 30 knots, so it's much faster and gets people where they're going a little faster.
So can we talk about the route? It's going to run between Hatteras and Silver Lake Harbor, which is right there in the heart of Ocracoke Village. About how long is the trip?
When we tested it out a couple of summers ago, it was about an hour and 10 minutes.
I understand that the idea for a passenger-only ferry was proposed at a time when visitation to Ocracoke Island was down. Is that right?
That is true. What has happened is the normal Hatteras-Ocracoke route used to take roughly a half hour because it was pretty much a direct shot between Hatteras and Ocracoke. Well, because of Mother Nature and some shoaling that has taken place, we have had to abandon that short route and take a longer route, which takes about an hour to get to the same place. Because of that, and because we only have so many boats, we have fewer trips in the summer months right now than we did 3-4 years ago. So that limits the number of people that can get to Ocracoke via the Hatteras Ferry, and it has had an impact on Ocracoke businesses.
Can you tell me about the study that was conducted in 2015 that looked at the feasibility of passenger ferry service to Ocracoke and how that may have helped move this project along?
Well, I mean, you never want to jump into a new service without studying it. And so when it became evident that we were going to be on this long route on the car ferry and that we weren't going to be able to have the number of trips that we've had, we did a study and we looked at all the options. We looked at whether it would be feasible to do a year-round dredging operation. We looked to see if a passenger ferry could go to the north end of the island. We looked at a lot of things, and this is the way that we found, that this study found, that will bring visitation levels back to where they should be and get people where they want to be and ease the congestion, and it was the one that stood out as the one that would work the best. Now, that shoaling is not getting any better, and a dredging operation would pretty much have to be a year-round operation, and it would be expensive, and it would be something we'd have to count on the Army Corps of Engineers for. So as it stands right now, the best way to get more people to Ocracoke during the summer season is a passenger ferry that goes right into the heart of the village and allows those people to walk around the village and not have to drive.
So I guess this passenger-only ferry would do two things. Of course, bring more people to the island and minimize congestion.
Yes, we see it as a win-win-win. First of all, it's a win for the day trippers that want to be able to know exactly when they're leaving and exactly when they're coming back because they'll be able to make a reservation. Say you have a reservation on the 10 o'clock ferry to Ocracoke. You know as long as you're there on time and get on the boat that you're not going to have to wait. And the same thing with coming back. So it's a big advantage for day trippers. For people that do want their cars, it should be an advantage for them too because it will lessen the congestion. There may no longer be the 1 hour, 2 hour waits. And then thirdly, it will be, I think, a boon for the downtown Ocracoke businesses because they'll get visitor levels back to where they were in the late 2000s.
Of course, more visitors means more tourism dollars being spent on Ocracoke, but how will the visitors get around the island?
Okay, well, first of all, you're right downtown, so anyone who wants to will be able to walk around the village on their own. People can bring their bikes. There will also be bikes for rent there in Ocracoke. There are golf carts to rent, and Hyde County plans to develop a tram system, whereas people who want to get around the village by vehicle will be able to do that and get to the lighthouse, to Howard's Pub, to any of these other places they might want to go in the village itself.
Construction on the catamaran-style ferry will begin soon in Swansboro. What other types of infrastructure improvements are needed before the ferry goes into operation?
We need some more parking, obviously. If people are going to leave their cars at Hatteras, we will need more parking, so we'll be building that. On the Ocracoke side, there will be, obviously, a floating dock that people can get off and on the ferry with, and some other improvements like rain shelters. We also have to come up with a reservation system. We want people to be able to book online, on their phones, even when they get to Hatteras. If they decide they don't want to wait for the car ferry and want to get there right away, we want to be able to sell them a ticket right there if need be.
So when will the new passenger-only ferry service, when do you expect that will be available to visitors?
Well, under the terms of the contract, the boat should get to us by the end of April next year. And then, of course, we'll have some testing and certification to go through. But we hope to have this thing up and running in time for the tourist season, you know, beginning Memorial Day-ish next year. So by this time next year, we hope everything will be running smoothly.
All right. Well, Tim Haas is the North Carolina Department of Transportation's Ferry Division Communications Officer. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
All right. Thank you.
This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Craft distillers are hoping a bill that's cleared the state Senate could give them a push to parity with local brewpubs and wineries. George Olson has more.
Right now, life as a craft distiller in the state is rather rough. You can only do appreciable sales of your product through the state alcohol beverage control system. Someone comes to your facility and takes a tour. They may then purchase a bottle, singular, and if they come back in 364 days for another, no sale. One bottle per person per year. They also can't go out in the community and promote their product. Craft Beer Festival, fine. Craft Spirits Festival, nope. That's why there's some excitement in the craft spirits industry about SB 155, which passed the state Senate last week.
The way the environment is, this is a huge step for them. And I think they understand that it's going to be slow going, but we are making progress. And, you know, it's like that old adage, you know, give you an inch, you take a mile. They're going to be happy for their inches as they come along the way.
John Francis Trump, the managing editor of the Carolina Journal and author of the recently released Still and Barrel, Craft Spirits in the Old North State, which profiles craft spirits producers throughout North Carolina. SB 155 would ease the reins on the craft spirits industry a bit. Trump's estimation is that raising the limit of bottle sales on site from one a year to five will have the biggest impact.
Many of the distilleries sell several products. And you've got to pick one during a calendar year and buy it on a year-to-year basis and buy it. You know, and people use creative means of getting friends or family and, you know, to get a couple bottles. But now you can pretty much, I would think, buy one bottle of every product. So it would give people the option of buying each one and buying five and then coming back again and revisiting. Because if you buy your bottle, maybe there's not a lot of impetus to come back, but if you buy a bottle here and buy a bottle there, there's more reasons to come back to take tours, you know, to do tastings, to bring friends.
SB 155 would also allow craft distillers to leave their facility from time to time, so to speak. For example, Covington Spirits in Snow Hill makes vodka from yams. Snow Hill has a sweet potato festival. Right now, Covington Spirits can't set up a booth and offer tastings at the sweet potato festival. Under SB 155, they could.
You go out to a festival, you go to a salute in Winston or a craft beer festival, which it just seems like every weekend now. And you could taste beers from different places, but you can't do that with liquor. So this would allow them to get out in the community and get people tasting them. Basically, what this does, and I think the goal of the bill is, and the sponsors have said this, is put them on par with the wineries and the breweries. To give them just as much of a chance to sell their product and get their product out there and known to consumers as, you know, breweries might or wineries might.
All of this comes with an important proviso. Anything regarding alcohol must have local approval, so the bill could pass, and the local government where your favorite craft distiller is located doesn't approve, no tastings at your local festival. Local approval is also necessary for the part of the bill that's received the most media attention so far, causing it to be dubbed the brunch bill. SB 155 would move alcohol sales on Sunday up from starting at noon to starting at 10 a.m. Before the bill's passage, it was amended to not only allow alcohol sales earlier on Sunday at restaurants, but also sales at grocery and convenience stores. That aspect has gotten the attention of social conservatives in the state who object to the earlier alcohol sales on Sunday. Trump says that's part of a long-time confrontation in the state, often referred to as Baptist versus bootleggers.
What happens in a house is yet to be seen, but I imagine those same arguments will rear themselves, and they may be a little more emboldened this time.
SB 155 is now under consideration in the State House, where Trump believes there's a pretty good path for passage. John Francis Trump is the managing editor of the Carolina Journal and author of Still and Barrel, Craft Spirits in the Old North State. I'm George Olson.
This is the Downeast Journal. The Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina announced that they are expanding their federal supplemental food program to reach more senior citizens in Eastern North Carolina. Today, Mac McKee speaks with the Senior Manager for Communications, Jessica Wichard, about the program, which provides vegetables, fruits, whole grains, protein, and dairy to seniors in need in Wake, Durham, Orange, Halifax, and Onslow counties.
When did you recognize that the need for expanding the commodity supplemental food program in other areas of the state, because it was originally only in Halifax County?
It was just operational in Halifax County, and in January, we kind of took it under our umbrella at the food bank, took a look at what other counties were in need, and have been operating the program since January.
Can you explain what the commodity supplemental food program is and how many seniors you're seeking to help?
Sure. Commodity Supplemental Food Program, or CSFP as we call it, is a federal program administered by the North Carolina Department of Agriculture. And we are looking to serve about 3,900 seniors at this moment. It provides them a monthly box with food to supplement what they're currently eating.
Why are you targeting Halifax and Onslow counties in particular?
We took a look at the counties in kind of a tiered fashion and where the highest need was based on income level, poverty level, and what we're seeing seniors in those areas, and eventually hope to be able to expand a little bit as we see the program being successful and really helping seniors.
Now, does your focus in Onslow County have anything to do with a large number of retired military members?
We didn't take a look at that specifically and really focused on, what the income level was for households and families. I think that certainly is a factor that could be taken into consideration, based on what retired military members are living on right now.
What are the qualifications to receive assistance from the Commodity Supplemental Food Program?
Seniors must be 60 years or older. They need to reside in one of the counties that we previously mentioned, and then have a gross income at or below kind of set requirements. I can talk to those a little bit if you would like me to.
Yeah, what are those requirements?
Sure. Depending on the number of people in the household, for instance, if you're a household of one, annual total income would be about $15,444, and then it increases depending on the number of people in the household. A two-member family could be $20,826, but we do have those kind of set guidelines in order for folks to sign up and be eligible.
How many people do you expect will sign up, and how many will you actually be able to help?
So we are looking, the numbers right now in Halifax are about 900 who we can serve, and then Onslow we're looking to build up to 600 seniors. And if we get more than that at the moment, then we do have waiting lists available. And again, as we're looking at expanding the programs, we'll be able to look at those lists and make sure that we're able to serve the seniors who have made the call and are interested in being eligible.
Jessica, how can seniors contact the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina to see if they qualify for the program?
We have a toll-free number set up. It is 1-800-358-358. 8189, and then they can press 2 specifically for the CSFP program.
Now, Jessica, if you had the opportunity to expand this program even more, are there other areas in eastern North Carolina where you might want to focus?
I think we'd be looking at, you know, some of the other surrounding counties. Edgecombe is one that comes to mind. But again, taking a look at the income levels and where we see the most need, we want to make sure that we're addressing those areas first.
Jessica Wichard is the Senior Manager for Communications at the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much, Mac. Appreciate it.
This is the Downeast Journal. An estimated 1 in 10 North Carolina adults have been diagnosed with diabetes. The condition is the 7th leading cause of death in our state. It's statistics like these that prompted an innovative program in Wilson County that aims to curb high diabetes and obesity rates with early intervention. Chris Thomas has more on Match Wellness, an interdisciplinary program empowering adolescents to make healthy decisions.
It's the end of the year at Springfield Middle School in Wilson County. Students are running the PACER test, an analysis of their endurance and speed, jogging up and down the school's basketball court until they're physically spent. Today's activity is part of a program designed to teach students of the pitfalls of an unhealthy lifestyle.
You look at a deck of cards. A deck of cards is what a portion of meat is supposed to be.
Catherine Alphen teaches PE at Springfield.
But what do? We go get a big old ribeye steak, and, you know, those pieces of meats are so big, and so we constantly eat and eat, and I think the portion control is what's hard.
Developing good habits now can help stave off the coercive impacts of sedentary lifestyles, including type 2 diabetes, which is one of several major public health issues in eastern North Carolina.
The reality is the eastern part of the state is actually one of the sickest areas of the country.
Dr. Suzanne Lazarick is Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Public Health at East Carolina University. She said if eastern North Carolina were a state itself, it would rank at or near the top for high rates of diabetes, hypertension, and obesity.
For children also, that means they're growing up in an environment with many, many adults who face these chronic issues, and childhood obesity is no exception. In eastern North Carolina, half of the children are either obese or overweight.
Wilson County is one of 30 North Carolina counties in the CDC's designated diabetes belt. It encompasses 644 counties across the country, all of which are below the Mason-Dixon line, where the likelihood of developing type 2 diabetes is highest in the U.S. A variety of factors contribute to these high rates, from lifestyle choices,
too much of things that have too many calories and not being active enough,
to things out of a person's control, especially children.
Diseases that tend to run in families, there are cultural issues, but there are also our genetic issues. So, I mean, that any racial group or ethnic group that has higher rates of diabetes just in their gene pool, like Hispanic populations or African-American populations, those are particularly African-American, are higher populations around here as well.
Many North Carolina counties in the diabetes belt, including Halifax, Edgecombe, Lenore, and Nash, are clustered around the northeastern corner of the state. Counties in the belt tend to have life expectancies below the state average of 78 years and have mainly minority populations.
The arteries in African Americans in general have less of ability to dilate appropriately. They don't create or secrete as much of this molecule called nitric oxide.
Dr. Damon Swift is a kinesiologist at East Carolina University. He also said the bodies of black people tend to be more insulin resistant. But a factor Swift says is often neglected across the board is physical fitness. Making the physical and academic connection to reduce the risk of diabetes and other diseases is one of the main goals of the MATCH program, which stands for Moving Adolescents with Technology to Choose Health. MATCH, which is in schools in North Carolina and Mississippi, is incorporated into the standard curriculum for 7th graders. ECU researcher Suzanne Lazarick explains.
Basically, the MATCH lessons walk the child through the content of what is obesity and why is it important, what behaviors lead to obesity. Then they get a chance to assess their own behaviors and see their own habits and set goals to change those behaviors. And so basically, those key concepts are repeated and applied through different classes over the course of several months, and, you know, with the hope to improve their motivation to change these behaviors as well.
Tools include using a pedometer to track the number of steps they take and spreadsheets to keep track of them, while also learning how to use software like Microsoft Excel. The program was conceived in Martin County by a physical education teacher, Tim Hardison. The county is also part of the Diabetes Belt, and when it was first implemented in 2006, it had the shortest life expectancy in North Carolina. Lazarick said the program can even be used to teach non-traditional classroom lessons, like how to balance a checkbook, while also tracking calorie intake.
Calories in is a deposit, or what you would save, and calories out is what you would expend or burn off with physical activity. And so the child can learn that concept of a bank or a checkbook, but using their own body as the metaphor, so to speak.
This is the first year it's been used at Springfield Middle School. Catherine Alphen says it helps pinpoint particular struggles individual students may have by keeping track of their height and weight, along with endurance tests like the pacer.
And the height and weight has been a huge eye-opener, because I've seen some of the students lose from the beginning to the end of the year, and they get so excited when they say that they've grown taller.
She says she enjoys the program in part because it gives her more opportunities to engage her students one-on-one.
I'm able to pull them to the side and just kind of talk to them about, you know, do you have a plan? You know, what's been going on?
After 10 years, Lazarick says the program has reached more than 15,000 adolescents in 46 schools. One of those students is 7th grader Lexi Bailey.
Well, sometimes it can be difficult, but it's most of the time it's easier to do.
What are sort of some of the difficult aspects of it?
Well, when you have to try and find the answers, it's kind of hard to. When you have to like do math problems on it and stuff, it gets kind of hard.
Lexi is from Sims in Wilson County.
Finding 3% of food you eat per day, it gets pretty hard.
According to Lazarick, about 15% of the students reached by the program have improved to a healthier weight category, with an estimated 1,500 students avoiding obesity. I'm Chris Thomas.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. I'm sure you've seen articles and advertisements. It seems that Epsom salts are being promoted to cure all things in the garden, whether it's bugs, diseases, or even blossom end rot on tomato. So the question I want to talk about today is, do Epsom salts really perform the miracles that people claim it does? First, we need to take a look at what Epsom salt is. It's a very simple chemical consisting of magnesium, sulfate, and some water. The water is tied up in the structure of the chemical, and we can ignore it. What about the magnesium and sulfur? Magnesium is one of the nutrients that plants need to grow. It's actually an important component of the chlorophyll molecule. It is, however, a minor nutrient, which means that plants don't need very much of it. Sulfate consists of sulfur and oxygen. Plants can absorb sulfate directly from the soil and use the sulfur molecule. It too is a minor nutrient for plants. So Epsom salt does work as a specific fertilizer. So what does a magnesium deficiency look like in plants? First of all, it is very hard to identify a nutrient deficiency just by looking at a plant. But in general, magnesium-deficient plants show yellowing on the edges of the older leaves. Plant tissue testing is the more accurate way to determine deficiencies. But let's say you're sure that your plant has a magnesium deficiency. It seems to make sense to add Epsom salt to the soil, right? Not necessarily. High levels of phosphorus in the soil solution affects the way plants absorb magnesium. So, a high phosphorus level in the soil can actually prevent plants from absorbing magnesium, even though there might be adequate amounts available in the soil. In this case, the solution is either to reduce the phosphorus level, which can be hard to do quickly, or increase the nitrogen level. Adding Epsom salt alone will not work. Soil chemistry is complicated. Adding nutrients just because you think they might be needed can actually cause more problems. So what about pests and diseases? Current scientific research has found that Epsom salts do not kill insects or grubs or repel slugs or rabbits, and there's no evidence that Epsom salts control any disease. Epsom salt is regularly recommended for tomatoes to prevent blossom end rot. But when you look at it, blossom end rot is a calcium deficiency in the fruit, not a magnesium deficiency. An excess potassium or magnesium fertilizer actually competes with calcium uptake by the plants. Since Epsom salt is a magnesium source, adding additional magnesium could actually increase blossom end rot. So Epsom salt is not a miracle product. Provided that your soil has enough magnesium, it will not make plants grow better, nor will it make more flowers or make tomatoes grow bigger. So when should a gardener use Epsom salts? Only if your soil test shows that you have a magnesium deficiency, or if you need to take a long, relaxing soak in the tub to soothe muscles made tired by weeding.